Hi, this is Alina and Megan, and you're listening to Move Your Brain, Move Your Body podcast, where we dive into all things health, wellness, and fitness.
We are two certified athletic trainers, personal trainers, and nutrition coaches who met and graduated together from the University of Arkansas. And we want to do this podcast to spread our joy about treating our bodies well through nutrition, exercise, and knowledge. Today on the podcast, we welcome guest David Bidler. David is a speaker, author, and leader in professional development. He is the CEO of Breathe to Perform, which shares the science of stress management and peak performance with industry leaders and their teams. He proudly serves as the president of the nonprofit organization Physiology First and presents material from the Breathe to Perform program to students and teachers throughout the United States. David owns the Distance Project Strength and Conditioning in Freeport, Maine, and is an avid endurance athlete and ultramarathon competitor. Alina and I have both gotten to know David through social media, and he is seriously one of the coolest guys with the best energy and a ton of great information. So we're really, really excited to have him on. Enjoy. All right. Today on the podcast, we have David Bidler. Welcome, David. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you all so much for having me on.
You're welcome. We're so happy to have you.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do, kind of how you came to be where you are today.
Well, you and I connected via your amazing Instagram, where we get so much inspiration from multiple levels, from a movement perspective, from a coaching perspective, and from what you're doing, because it's so clearly integrating concepts around mental well-being, physical well-being in an empowering way. And that's kind of what we began to do when we built the Distance Project. The Distance Project is a strength and conditioning center in Freeport, Maine. We've been doing this for about 9 years now. And it started out as a group of people working in a parking lot together, just training. And it was really cool to be able to take like an antithetical business model and not do the normal gym thing. We just kept meeting up in a parking lot. We kept pushing each other. We kept building community and tribe and training programs. And we got enough people who kept coming back to this crazy environment that we could rent out a tiny little office. It was a 450 square foot lawyer's office. And we're like, we're either going to get away with this or we aren't. You know what I mean? Because there's like a lawyer next door, right? And we made it into a gym and we kept training together and the community grew and we were able to take kind of a bigger place and use it as a hub for not only for training and community building, it's an invite-only training center, but to build maybe a better conversation on like what fitness even is in 2020. What does it mean? What is its relevance? What does it mean to be fit with other people? And what components, physical, social, mental, have to fit into that archetype for it to be worth pushing ourselves towards kind of a brighter future together, not just a bigger deadlift together?
Yes. I mean, if 2020 has taught us anything, it's that taking care of our health is paramount. But also what you were just saying, like we've been like pretty socially isolated this whole time, you know? And so not only is like movement important, but just that sense of community and sense of being able to take care of your mental well-being and having the tools and the understanding of physiology to do that. And what I love about your content and just what you're doing, at least as far as I've come to know you over the last couple of months, is just that you are doing just that. You're giving people the tools to sort of influence their physiology and their mind through their physiology, and kind of goes back both ways.
It's just, you know, when we first started the Distance Project and got people training together, you know, we started to ask, like, again, like, what qualities would you want to train? And we thought a lot about sensory motor qualities. We've only trained barefoot. We thought a lot about social qualities. We start every class with a question to go a little deeper than the normal kind of BS with each other and really get to know who's in the room. And we thought about the quality of building real community and friendship. And the reason that we chose to use an invite-only model is our goal was if we can get like 20 or 30 people coming back every week or a couple times a week to train together, you can use that as a hub to look at the bigger picture issues that are really important to you and others in that community and say, how do we leverage having a group of people who care about health and fitness and performance and have a physical training space and have the ability to really like ask good and challenging questions together and try to get to the heart of some of the issues we saw in our community. And we're based in Freeport, Maine. And before COVID, 1 in 4 kids in Freeport, Maine are diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder. And that's a higher number than the national average of 1 in 5. And yet we weren't hearing a conversation on like what anxiety even means. We're hearing mental health being talked about in this abstract and vague way. And I don't build, and I know that you don't build training programs in vague and abstract ways. I want to know like what quality strength was, what quality speed was. I'd want to know about the thing, the physiology of the person, and then build a program that could influence it. But when we looked at mental health, it was like, we're talking about these in vague abstracts. So how can we help a high school athlete who's in the gym saying, you know, I have panic attacks every day. I can't sleep at night. Feeling really depressed and I don't know what to do. How can we build archetypes to even understand what that means so that we can build a training program to look at things that, to look at mental health in a proactive way? So that's kind of how we changed our model from just being like a fitness and endurance training center to building out projects like Physiology First, our nonprofit organization.
I love that.
It's amazing. What you're doing is amazing. So where are you from? That's something I was just thinking about when you were...
New Jersey.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you end up in Maine?
You know what? I used to come up here with family when I was a kid. It was so not New Jersey.
Yeah.
Opposite of New Jersey. And later on in my life, I ended up just kind of coming back. I really got into mountain running and trail running. And competing in ultra marathon races became like a passion of mine. So I started to ask like, hey, where are there good mountains and cool places to kind of settle down? And Portland, Maine, if you're ever in the area, is just such a cool city.
I've heard.
And within an hour, you can get to these amazing mountains and run and train.
Yeah, cool. So one of the highest number of youth with, you said with anxiety, or what did you say, mental health?
Generalized anxiety.
I was going to say that seems so not random, but like, why do you think that is in Maine? You know,
such a good question. Such a good question. I mean, it could be because the study was faulted, right? I mean, like all this research is really, really interesting in how it's conducted because there are so many, it's hard to get accurate data, right?
Definitely.
But let me give an example that's kind of a sobering one, but it'll take us to the mental health side of this conversation pretty quickly. When we went into lockdown, our company, Breathe to Perform, which is a professional development company that works around using breath education to manage state and to better mental and physical well-being. We were doing work with schools already, bringing an infrastructure for a respiratory education curriculum that included mental and physical well-being elements to schools and universities. And as soon as the quarantine happened, we thought, well, through our nonprofit organization that we'd started later, we could offer this stuff to schools. We can say, well, like there can be a mental health education curriculum that shows young folks like what's going on with COVID for one. Mm-hmm. And what proactive things that can do to improve their mental health for two, and that we could share that curriculum. And it was this free curriculum was rejected by every school in Maine. So it's a school that other districts were paying for that they wouldn't even accept in. We haven't learned in Maine how to talk about mental health. If we put up a post about doing a community event at the gym, and we often do try to tie this into the performance realm because it at least helps to negate some of the initial stigma.
Yeah.
Yeah, run ultra marathons and do heavy deadlifts. Also, mental health is really cool because it's like our brain and stuff. Like, this should be fun. This is like developing ourselves in the truest way, you know? Mm-hmm. But in Maine, that doesn't resonate. There's still this New England sort of, I don't even know what it is, but it's certainly not an eagerness or curiosity to explore that topic. Mm-hmm. Very recently, we had a 16-year-old boy 20 minutes from our gym commit suicide. And the silence in the community was deafening. There wasn't even a conversation on like, well, what does that reflect? What can be done from here? What infrastructure could show somebody at 16 or any age, what the physiological prerequisites for mental well-being even are? What things do they need to know about the body and the brain and about emotions and about state and about isolation? And like that curriculum just doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
No. It's like we're in an incredible white space where the opportunity for innovation, restructuring education is right now and right here. And then it's like, well, what pathway do you take in? Who's receptive to hearing this? And one thing that we can say is that the students are. They're the first ones who want to talk about mental health. Like there's no stigma. They're like, hey, let's rock. I want to feel awesome. I have goals.
Yeah.
So the question becomes, how do you reach them most effectively in a way that's empowering and in a way that they can also ultimately be led to people like yourselves, ongoing intergenerational mentors? Not one-time conversations.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Go ahead, Alina.
It's super interesting, like, well, all you're talking about mental health, and in the last maybe, 10 years, like, I had recess growing up. We had an hour recess, and I think that's something that's cut down. And it's kind of to talk about what you're talking about with just like this mental health aspect is you're taking away this piece of recess that these kids have growing up. I don't know what it's like in Maine, but I'm sure it's along the rest of what the rest of the country is doing. Yeah. You're adding in not the best lunch food, which doesn't get their brain powered up feeling great. And then you're not educating them on their breath and how they're sitting and doing different things and throughout their day, which could prevent a lot of these issues. You can't change that it gets really dark during like early hours in places like Maine. You can't change that, but you can change people's outlook to wanting to move their body to help them with their depression, let's say.
So. Yeah. Well, even just the name Breathe to Perform, could you go into a little bit more behind that? Because I think it would be really beneficial for our listeners to be given that tool. I think breathing is kind of like, it's funny because it's like a fad, which is hilarious because obviously we don't do it every day. But people are realizing that we can actually like reverse engineer our physiology in a way by paying attention to our breath and manipulating our breath. So can you go into that a little bit?
Absolutely. So from the Distance Project, we were working a lot with endurance athletes. We were asking questions about aerobic capacity and aerobic development and endurance sports qualities. And at the same time, we're working with, when I say young people, I mean, we have athletes here in their 80s who also will experience different physiological states. We talk a lot about sleep and stress and anxiety and mental state and all that with all of our people. And when we wanted to figure out, like, who is doing quantified, interesting, in-depth, important work on stress physiology? Because like, there's so much research done on muscle physiology. We kind of have an idea of like progressive overload, like what you might do to get a person stronger. There are concepts that seem to work more often than not. And we weren't even having this conversation where anxiety meant something that we can define, where stress meant something that we can define. So we took a trip a few years ago out to Stanford University, where our friend Dr. Andrew Huberman is doing some of the most revolutionary work in neuroscience, I think. Yeah. And at the time, he just started this experiment, this VR experiment, where you can go into this VR fear lab that he created. And they would expose you to these different fears. You're swimming with great white sharks, you're fending off attack dogs, there's like tarantulas popping out of a wall, and you have a digital baseball bat to like defend yourself, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was super fun. And they're putting on VR goggles and they're measuring pupillimetry and they're measuring skin temperature and they're measuring respiration. And it's like, what happens to a human being when you make it anxious and stressed? And then what behaviors can immediately, most effectively manage that state? What does it mean to influence the autonomic nervous system? What happens when you are stressed and anxious and you want to exit that state? And so through this experiment, you'd go through these different interventions in between the exposures to these stress states. And they would try things like meditation and hypnosis and placebos. And it was always patterns of vision and patterns of breath that become this remote control system to the nervous system. Mm-hmm. Lower heart rate, and you can change pupillimetry and you can change skin temperature. And we thought, well, wow, that takes minutes and a little bit of understanding about the brain and body. And when you have a student who's feeling like they're going to have a panic attack up on a stage giving a speech, or anybody about to go into a job interview, go into a presentation, whatever it is, if they could have that skill of state management, irrespective of psychology, just pure physiology, then they would have a power tool for the century that we're in. And so when we came back from that experience, we built the company Breathe to Perform to offer professional development to workplace teams and sports teams and others to bring a whole seminar experience to them. And it was from that year or two that we recognized, like, Breathe to Perform is a company. We charge money for professional development. And we thought, like, the schools didn't have that money. Mm-hmm. Like, schools in our community didn't have money to do this stuff. And it's like, how do you bridge this? We're working with CEOs and we're working with high-level athletes on this stuff. And we're working with teams. Who's working with the lacrosse team at the high school? Who's working with the junior high kids?
The future.
Like, how will this circuitous path that we all took to getting to want to know ourselves in some way, like, would that just hopefully happen randomly for everybody in a local high school? Or can you bring this into the base level of foundational curriculum? Mm-hmm. And that's why we built the nonprofit, was to say, let's take what we're doing with Breathe to Perform and other things. Because breath is this foundation, but then you have sleep and nutrition and exercise and actual tangible skills like understanding the economy, understanding social media,
Yeah.
Why are they used at the base of a curriculum at a time when they're so critical? That should we ask?
Yeah, definitely. It's just so cool. Like, because I've worked with high school kids for the last several years since I got out of grad school. And I mean, you can tell the athletes who are good at like kind of managing themselves and the ones who kind of just lose it. And I feel like I had more access to social media than my parents did when I was in high school and college. But like now, like I cannot imagine being in high school, going through all the things that high schoolers go through while also having social media. Cause like I'm on Instagram a lot. Like I mean, my business is on there. I think it's a really great platform. I've met lots of cool people this year, but like, if you're not careful, it can really affect like your mental health. And I know that kids these days, not only are we more sedentary than ever, but we're also inundated with just all this stimulus, you know, all that visual input on screens. And so just understanding what that does to your, like your lizard brain is so important. You know, we need to take it back to the lizard brain so that we can kind of influence from the outside in. And exercise is another thing. Like, again, many people don't have like a regular exercise routine because they either have analysis paralysis or they're just don't have any interest in it. But if we could just understand that it's more than just like a physique goal or losing weight, it's literally like hormetic stress to give you like more power for the rest of your life, you know, and your brain, like it's so interconnected and it makes total sense. If you just think about like animals, you know, you get an animal to not do anything and it doesn't thrive. We're no different.
100%. You know, an analogy we always use at seminars with kids is like, who here has flung a cat off a bed? Like the cat was at this, you woke up and the cat's like, wah! It's like, you know, 10 feet in the air, it lands. It's as stressed as anything's ever been stressed.
Yeah.
It's like, ah! And then it lands and it does this quick threat assessment. Mm-hmm. When there is no threat, it goes back to sleep.
Yeah.
It has the on-off switch for the nervous system. That's like, high threat, no, it's cool, I'm good. And we don't have that. We'll remember an argument we got into yesterday, you know, and be totally jacked up for a day.
Or yesterday.
Somebody threw up in traffic, right? You're like, ah!
Most people remember arguments from 5 years ago and still bring them up, just so you know.
Have you read, speaking of Stanford, have you read Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers?
I love Sapolsky's work so much.
Such a good book.
We try to bring that stuff to the kids because when Sapolsky was on Sam Harris's new book, I would recommend to any human being.
Is that the 10% Happier?
This one was called Making Sense. And it was his best podcast conversations of like, I don't know, the decades.
Cool.
Kahneman was on it and Robert Sapolsky's on it. Really, really cool. And when Sapolsky talks about the neurobiology of depression,
mm-hmm.
Sapolsky's interesting because he's at Stanford like for a good part of the year. And then he's also a primatologist. So mm-hmm. he goes and like shoots baboons with like darts to like see what they can study about like baboon culture. And he comes back to Stanford and studies human culture. And it's like, you're looking at these intersections of neurobiology.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, this is maybe the first generation who's had access to the kind of neuroscience data that we can better understand our brains and what they're trying to, how the brain is trying to make sense of the world and how states become prompts for behavior. When we present to students and we ask like, who here thinks, you know, anxiety is a big problem? Every hand goes up in every seminar ever. And then we're like, who can like define anxiety? And I haven't heard a working definition of the world or of the word in any seminar we've ever done. And there's always like this kind of moment of quiet. We had a young woman say, you know, I just got diagnosed with anxiety the other day and I want to die. And I thought that's a really powerful statement, a really powerful statement. And we asked like, you know, like who can define anxiety? And nobody. And it's like,
it's
well, what
different
is
for everybody.
What is it like neurophysiologically?
Right.
What can you study about it? And if something is an illness, then we have one way to talk about it and kind of address it. But if it's the natural physiological response to a set of external stimuli, mm-hmm. if that's what happens when you exhaust someone and stick them in front of a 4x6-inch screen that signals their level of social approval every 8 seconds,
yeah,
mm-hmm. you top it off with a lot of caffeine and then you totally, and then you quarantine them.
Yeah. What do you expect?
I always take it back to like, what if you had like a rat in an experiment and you were to stimulate it and shine bright lights in its face and keep it awake? You would see stress physiology change. And then you can say, oh, when I do that, that happens.
Right. And that stress physiology too is like, goes back to the hormones too. It's all
oh
that,
God.
the short term is going to affect the long term if the short term becomes chronic. So,
absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. So, talk me a little bit more about breathing. I'm just scrolling through your Instagram because I was like, I'm sure there'll be something interesting we could talk about. Let's talk about squatting. Total change of subject, but not really because it still has to do with breathing. But
breathing, squatting, that's what it's all about.
It yeah. has to do with increasing your stressors.
Yeah, there you go. So, I know that we've all, at least I have recently learned more about just like the really precise mechanics of like the squat and the deadlift and like the influence that we can have on our positions of our bones by breath work. Can you go into a little bit more about that post, squatting is breathing, and why that is?
Well, you know, when I got into coaching, I came in through the CrossFit lens. I was an ultra marathon runner who had never done a loaded squat or a barbell, you know, movement in my life.
Yeah.
And I came through, like a lot of people did, into this tunnel, which was CrossFit. And I got thrown into it, and it changed my life because I was moving weight with others. Mm-hmm. And I think what I gained was that's probably important, like moving weight with others, you know? And I had no idea how crappily, if that's a word, that I was moving. I thought that it was like fine that my back always hurts. Like I just figured it was like the cost of training, you know? And I'm just early in this learning journey, you know? I meet people like you. I meet people like Katie Sinclair, who's a shared mentor, who are working to better understand what it was like to look at movement from a skeletal perspective and ask some critical questions about the archetype that the person's in before you start to load them and to understand the different business models that are at play. I didn't understand at the time why there were 9 movements of CrossFit. I thought it was very convenient. I'm like, I only have to think from 9 movements. This is great. And then it's like, oh, I get it. I see why that's like that. And what I believe is that I am fortunate to have gotten to watch the gap between, like, I'm, again, early in this learning journey about breathing from a biomechanics perspective. We really got excited about breathing from a neurophysiology perspective and working with the neuroscience community to better understand the root causes of things like anxiety, to look at the prevalence of overbreathing, to measure CO2 tolerance and get a sense of what that might mean. And that's what led me into trying to get a better grasp on, like, human biomechanics. As we remember, all of us, how new that whole concept is. Like, I used to look at the body as like a kind of like a meat marionette. You kind of tug on this, and then this moves, right? And it's like you're trying to kind of figure it out, and nothing made sense to me in the entire world of movement, strength, and conditioning. I'm like, this just something's not right. Until I came into the world of like PRI, and that seems to be like the common connector to everybody that I talk with who got into breathing. Like, oh, something got me into PRI, and I thought, this is like the first methodology that made any sense to me. It's just like put things together. It's like, oh, I get it. Like if my pelvis is here and my ribs are like pointed that way, that's why you're squatting like that. And that's why my back always hurts. And that's why I'm dealing with these chronic compensations. And so I think we may be seeing this really awesome merger of coaches who hadn't been exposed because they haven't gone through PT school. They haven't had a background in exercise physiology. They just wanted to help people train. Mm-hmm. And now like, with Instagram, it's like yours, it's like easier to learn this stuff. You're like, wow, I don't have to stumble upon this through meeting somebody at the seminar that linked me to the next seminar.
Yeah.
You can be like, hey, follow this person. You're like, mind blown.
Yeah, and so it's more digestible. I feel like it's so digestible because it's like all these different minds have kind of taken in the same ideas. Like I've never taken a PRI course ever, but I feel like I've gained so much just through the people that I have associated myself with so that I understand some of the concepts. I mean, I definitely understand the basic concepts, and you can observe it. You can see like how your cues when you're coaching someone or just kind of giving them a different preparatory movement for their specific position. You can even tell like how someone lives their life, you know, if they're super anxious or if they're like a high level athlete. Like I have a client who was a really high level hurdler and she's like lives on her toes. And her external rotation on one leg is like crazy on that leg. And the other leg, it seems like normal because her trail leg, obviously you can just tell someone's history just by looking at their body. And it's just, it's so cool. And it's so much deeper than a lot of people go. And I mean, I love it. I love it.
I love that you said that. Cause like, we think about like, you could think about the nervous system, like a guitar string, mm-hmm. like you're tuning a guitar string and like, you probably don't want it to like pop. You know, you probably want to have it be able to hit a note. And when you look at different levels of like autonomic nervous system tone, you're like, oh yeah, totally. I get why you're ready to jump right out of your skin.
Yeah.
And I get why you're just about to snooze, and it's really, really kind of like a just a different starting baseline. So when we have athletes come into the gym, we start with breathing often, because everybody comes in from a totally different world outside. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we try to create a conversation around is like, look, I can kind of like whip you up into like an energetic state. If we start to blast some Wu-Tang and we jump around this gym and put chalk on our hands, we're all going to be in a different nervous system state. But like, I want you to do that for you before you come in, because then you're entering the environment with like agency and presence and focus. And then you can do it in other environments. And then I can do it to work to model it too. These are the things that I think are so interesting with breathing. It's like, I love, we just had a class focused on the sacrum and nutation and counter nutation of the sacrum, and better understanding this whole concept of butt wink and this having different athletes. What was really fun is we finally, Lex got me for Christmas a pelvis model. And it's like, huzzah. That's all that we needed to talk about the concept, because you can't see through people. Uh-huh. You know, so we had people doing a squat against a wall with a foam roller, and just, you know, back against the foam roller, having them drop as low as they can. We're watching what the pelvis does. And then we're like, well, what if we gave that person like a block between the knees, and they were squeezing the block between the knees as they descend? And you're like, oh, well, that totally changes the shape. What's up with that? And then we can kind of grab the pelvis model and say like the sacrum's either moving towards the spine or away in every squat you choose. So just like make a choice. Like, why are you doing that? You know, and then they can think about it, and you watch the different level of attention and motor control as they're figuring out this part of their body. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's the coolest thing, because we're just animals learning about ourselves and then getting really excited to share this stuff, you know?
Yeah, it is really crazy how you can just, if you just either change your cue or just like kind of get there, I don't know, what do you say, like the meat marionette? I mean, you're a puppeteer as a coach, you know, with the cueing and just getting someone to get it in a better position, it can completely change their motor control. I mean, I'm obviously started PT school today, and I know Lex is also. And I mean, I really think that most clinicians really underestimate what people's bodies are capable of. And that may be one reason why people are chronically in PT. Like, they're getting them, like, the stimulus is so low. And like, obviously most people are pretty deconditioned, so you don't want to like slam them into a bunch of volume, but it sometimes takes more of a stimulus to get a change, at least one that's going to stick. You know, I mean, no one's going to adapt unless they have a reason to. So
I love that you said that, you know, and we try with our work to really kind of hammer on this concept of adapt on purpose. Mm-hmm. Just like adapt on purpose. Don't let it be what I wrote on a board. Don't let it be what somebody else told you. Like, adapt on purpose. Like, we're this biological organism with the capacity for adaptation that we control. That's awesome. Like, that's like the most exciting thing. And then it draws out like this harder thing, which is clarity. Mm-hmm. It's like, if you're a biological organism that can adapt on purpose based on the stresses that we avoid or introduce, you get to this really cool place of like, well, who am I? I'm like, who do I want to be? And that's so cool. And it's like, I think that that can make fitness and all this stuff transcend the sport field.
Yeah.
Because we find a lot of athletes who come in, you know, and one of the biggest thing we'd hear is, I used to be an athlete. You know, it's like, I used to be an athlete then. And it's like, well, like, life's a sport. Like, there's crazy stuff going on. Like, we got to train every damn day. Like, the world's pretty chaotic. Like, you know, stop being an athlete. And so you can get them back into their body through breathing. And when you give them the right cue and they say, wow, I really felt that, you don't have to hammer them with stimulus. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do 50 burpees in a weight vest. You can say, wait a minute, let's get you breathing well. Let's get you to feel that muscle. And then you're going to be empowered by the fact that you can develop that muscle should you want to continue. Stress it, you know?
Totally. If you have a body, you're an athlete. It's Bill Bowerman.
100%. Life is a sport.
Co-founder of Mikey. Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. So actually, on that note, we have a question that we ask everybody. What is something that you do every day to move your brain, move your body, or both?
I'm taking a second to ask that or to answer that, because it's changed a lot in the past couple of years. You know, I got into this whole thing doing ultra distance running, and I was running upwards of 100 miles a week at one point.
Oh my God.
And I think like we finally built a system that meets the goal that we set out, which is, I want to know that my 80-year-old athletes feel better next year, that they can move better next year, that they feel more confident and strong, that their balance is better next year. I want to look at my 10 and 11, 12-year-old athletes and think, how can we build a program that actually lasts for life? It's not a 16-week block. It's not sport specific. Like, what does it look like to build your body in a way that actually has longevity and performance connected? Mm-hmm. And so today I train every day here at our gym. Every day, right now, I'm actually doing a program, which I can't say enough about, which is Mass 2 by Dr. Pat Davidson. The program's so good. We have athletes, we have 8-year-olds and 80-year-olds doing Mass 2.
Wow.
And we just kill it. Like, we just change the movements, you know? So we just had a class before this conversation of eight people in here, high school athletes, teachers. Everybody's doing Mass 2. So right now what I'm doing with my body is Mass 2. It's a great program.
That's awesome. I've never read it, but I've been really interested in reading all of his books because I'm currently reading The Coach's Guide to Optimal Movement. Optimizing Movement. Oh my God. It's so, he just takes the most like complex topics and just makes them so clear. Like the way that he can describe an exercise through words without a picture, I'm like, yeah, I know exactly what he's talking about. It's crazy. Like that's hard to do.
He's so good. We got to see Pat speak maybe like 8 years ago. He gave this lecture on dopamine, and I can't tell you how much I learned in an hour. And what he was talking about, you know, I to even tie this back to the mental health piece, you know, he was talking about dopamine and addiction and understanding dopaminergic urges and understanding dopamine concentration. Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't want to misquote him, but I think he said something like, look, like, you're either going to like rob a 7-Eleven or start a company, right? Like really high dopamine concentration. Like the advice is not chill out and find level ground. You're not going to be happy on level ground. You're going to go and do something extreme if you have a very high concentration of dopamine. So how do we better understand how we coach people through things like having an addictive personality and getting addicted to feeling good and giving back? Right? Feeling good and giving back and saying it's not going to be, if it's not enough for you to run a 5K and you're going to run, have to run 100-mile races and things like that. Well, cool. Like learn what that is neurologically. Because it may have like positive and negative ways that are like probably super important to know about. And we try to show that to kids. Like what is dopamine? What does it do?
We're actually going to try and get him on this podcast and maybe I'll send this over to him. He's such a nice guy. I actually had the privilege to like train with him a little this summer. And he's hilarious. Second, he's just a really nice guy. And then he's so smart. So you can just have a 15-minute conversation with that dude and you're mind blown. So yeah, it's just cool how you can recall that about the dopamine and just awesome stuff. You're so much good stuff you gave us in this podcast. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, just imagine if high school kids knew that about themselves.
Yeah.
Imagine that it was at the base of educational curriculum to learn about you before you tried to learn about things.
It's a superpower.
You're like, well, I have to know about me. And then I could try to understand the external world, but we've done it backwards. Mm-hmm. So you have students who know about industries that may not be here by the time that they can enter them.
Yeah.
They know how to take care of their mind, their body, their breathing. And I think that this is the time when we're going to see education disrupted at a mass scale, both from educational technology companies, from people who are not putting their kids back in the educational infrastructure, and from innovators in school themselves, who are going to be rewriting the foundation of education. It's like, wow, what if we can collectively make an impact on how that's written? And we can put brain and body-based learning at the actual foundation and then tackle the complexity of the world from that perspective.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on. We may have to have you on again at some point, just because I feel like I could talk to you forever about this stuff. We're passionate about the same topics.
If people want to learn more about Breathe to Perform, where can they find you?
So they can go to @BreatheToPerform on Instagram. And if they want to know about our youth mental health work specifically, they can follow us at Physiology First on Instagram or Twitter, or physiologyfirst.org. And you'll see the mental health education curriculum that we're working to build that any student can access, teachers can access, and parents can access to implement this stuff right away.
So useful right now. Thank you so much for all you're doing, David. It's pretty awesome.
Thank you so much, Megan. And thank you for contributing to the larger curriculum so we can make this stuff accessible.
So awesome.
All right. Well, we will talk to you soon. Have a good one. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you both enough. Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Move Your Brain, Move Your Body podcast. Join in every week as we release new episodes.
Subscribe or leave us a rating at Apple Podcasts. If you have questions or topics to cover, please email moveyourbb@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram @moveyourbb.